L'Officine Universelle Bouly presents Ancient Beauty Rituals, Episode 7, To the Sublime Port. The young and secretive Amel indulges in a last hammam before she tries to escape the harem. 1630 Constantinople, Ottoman Empire. I haven't slept all night. My plan kept tossing around in my head. For two full moons, I have worked at perfecting it, and today is the day I give it life. Last night, as the harem celebrated the new life in the chief consort's womb, I lay quietly in my chamber, having made an excuse of feeling a fever coming on. The velvety touch of the exquisite bedspread, the ceiling lamp shimmering with the reflection of its flickering candles, the familiar rustling of the leaves in the breeze outside the chamber balcony, they all seemed to beg me to reconsider. But, restless with fraught and worry, I thought and rethought, going over every step of my plan to escape the palace confines tomorrow. Let me introduce myself. I was Amel before I was given the name of Gulnaz at the harem. It means pretty rose. As 16-year-old Amel in the village of Misi, around 95 miles south of Constantinople, my carefree days were spent helping my mother with the household chores in our modest home, or playing with my younger brother. With midnight black hair cascading till my waist, porcelain skin flush like a pink rose starting to bloom, doe-shaped eyes and a slender waist, I was the center of attention of the village men, and the envy of young girls and their mothers. But I had eyes only for Ahmed, my childhood love. We had grown up from being playmates to inseparable soulmates, promising ourselves to each other. Then came the slave traders. Having heard stories of my beauty, they sought me out for the Sultan's harem in Constantinople. The district governor, sensing an opportunity to advance his relationship with the palace, forced my mother to give me up. And much against my wishes, screaming and thrashing, I was taken away from my family and Ahmed. Now, after 2 years as a palace concubine, with my plan etched in my mind, I was going to escape, to be reunited with Ahmed, the man who is Sultan of my heart. He who still awaited my return to his arms. The Ottoman Empire's imperial harems of the 16th and 17th century have been much written about in history. Contrary to the popular sexualized image of a harem, it was a sacrosanct place where the women of the family found a safe and respectable retreat. It was the women's quarter in a Muslim household. The imperial harem held the combined households of the Sultan's mother, the Queen Mother, his favorite consorts, and the rest of his concubines. It also contained the households of the Sultan's unmarried daughters. Young girls of unmatched beauty were sent to the Sultan's courts, often as gifts from the governors. Many harem women were Circassians, Georgians, and Abkhazians. At the harem, the girls were taught to dance, recite poetry, play musical instruments, and master the erotic arts. Only the most gifted were presented to the Sultan as his personal maids-in-waiting. The harem operated under a strict hierarchy of women that began with the odalisques, or chambermaids, at the bottom, up to the supreme power of the Queen Mother. The young women secretly sought to go up the ladder, hoping to rise to the stature of Haseki, or chief consort of the Sultan. The harem complex was a collection of spacious anterooms with a large meeting room in the center. The women socialized in the anterooms with their female guests and slaves. Inside the rooms, built-in divans, raised platforms, lined the three walls, on which were placed exquisitely embroidered cushions of silk and brocade. Windows overlooked beautiful gardens in the harems of the wealthy. Gulnaz, wake up! We're going to the hammam. Don't be late, else you'll never hear the end of it from the assistant master. I hear one of the girls call out to me from the general concubine's floor, a short level below mine. As a favourite of the Sultan, I have the privilege of my personal room on the floor at the upper level, along with the rooms of the other favourites. The day has arrived. Waking up with a start, I can hear the morning commotion of the girls gathering their baskets of toiletries and neatly folded peshtemals and havlis, the long cotton towels to wrap themselves in at the hammam, and the smaller towel to dry with. I stretch and sit up slowly, my mind outpacing my actions. From now on, every step will take me closer to freedom. But one wrong move, and I can lose my life. For now, I have to act my usual self and look forward to the favourite part of my day, the luxurious bathing ritual and socialising with the girls at the hammam. I pick up my basket, putting in the towels and the olive and rose oil soap I love so much, which leaves my body fragrant like the roses in my village. Then goes in the pretty rose water bottle to wash my face with, and the apricot oil for moisturising myself. Anastasia, can I borrow your bottle of the lavender and carnation scent? I call out to my only friend in the harem. Today I need my confidence, wits, and my sense of self-preservation. And I hope the scent makes me fearless, like the powerful Queen Harem Sultan from a century ago, who loved to wear it. I quickly drop my delicately crafted jewellery box in the basket, and picking up a pair of wooden hammam clogs inlaid with mother-of-pearl, I file out of the room with the other girls, all under the sharp eye of the assistant master. The exquisitely purifying and relaxing ritual of the hammam, or Turkish bath, is a few centuries old. In Arabic, it means spreader of warmth. It originated in Arabia and made its way into the bathing traditions of the Ottomans, who merged it with the Roman public bathhouse traditions, birthing a cleansing ritual that met the requirements of Islam. While cities and towns had their public hammams, imperial palaces and the elite had private ones, usually located at the end of a flower-lined pathway within the harem complex. It included a sequence of rooms with increasing temperature gradation, housed under domed structures. The grand entrance, many times with a central fountain, led into the cool room, or the changing and disrobing area, where one stored their belongings and changed into their bathing attire. Sunlight entered the changing room through a roof lantern at the top of the dome. This was followed by spending some time in the warm room, or ikikli, where thick, wet steam relaxed the muscles and detoxified the body. An activity similar to the modern-day steam and sauna. Finally, the hot room experience beckoned. Circular or star-shaped windows, called elephant eye, were cut out in the ceiling to let in natural light. A marble platform, rectangular or octagonal in shape, called the Göbek Taşı or the belly stone, about 45 to 50 centimetres in height, was constructed in the middle of the hot room and was used for massages, soaping and scrubbing. The hot room was called the Sikaki. Kurnas or wash basins lined the walls in the hot room at suitable distances. Keeping their garments in the changing room, women wrapped themselves in the long cotton towels or peshtemels. A smaller towel, called havli, was used for drying. After the hair was towel-dried and combed, a gauze-like turban was wound around the head to absorb any remaining moisture. The elite often had elaborate embroidery on the borders of their towels. They then wore the high-heeled wooden clogs, called nalin, which prevented the bather from slipping on the wet floor or getting their feet dirtied in the soapy water runs. The base of the clogs was generally carved out of solid hardwoods like plane, walnut, ebony and sandalwood, embellished with silver, gold, mother-of-pearl, tortoise shell and sometimes tiny bells, with a strap of fabric or leather decorated with valuable stones, pearls, silver thread and embroidery that wrapped over the wearer's foot, made the clogs a piece of art. Every woman had 13 to 14 different bathing accessories, indicating the richness of the Turkish bath culture. The bath bowl came in silver, bronze or copper, decorated with reliefs or inlays. The soap dish was a lidded container, oval-shaped with holes at the bottom and a handle on top. Soaps, combs, rubbing and lathering mitts were placed in it. After undressing, jewellery was kept in a pumpkin-shaped metal container. Round or oval-shaped mirrors, framed with delicately carved wood or silver, were used. An interesting tradition was to partake fruit, lemonade, or various fruit juices and sherbets before or after a bath. Walking into the hammam, a stone's throw from our living quarters, a familiar sense of relaxation overcomes me. The spaciousness of the entrance with its high ceiling, the cool touch of the marble beneath my feet, and the captivating sense of jasmine, eucalyptus, rosemary and lemon wafting around. I can't help but feel optimistic about my impending plan for freedom. We slowly make our way into the changing room. The languorous atmosphere loosens tongues, and suddenly the changing room echoes with laughter, enthusiastic chatter and secrets being murmured. Soon, articles of clothing are strewn on the ground and benches. Some of the girls help themselves to the sherbet and fruit being served and hang around the central fountain. It's a beautiful mess, and everyone is distracted, busy with themselves and their friends. A most appropriate location for executing my plan. Ever since I arrived from Mizi, I have found respite from my intense longing for home and Ahmed in the elaborate rituals of hammam bathing. At the hammam, you cannot hurry things up. The steam must be allowed to seep into your pores. The masseuse takes her sweet time coaxing the muscles to relax. The fragrance of cleansing clays and henna soothe the senses, and applying the beautifying oils anchor you to the present moment. The girls are busy sharing stories of life back in the villages, exchanging notes on keeping youthful, gossiping about the assistant masters, and their collective crush on the handsome music teacher. To avoid raising any suspicion, I look involved. I laugh at last night's gossip, ask about the music, the dishes, and entertainment offered by the chief consort in celebration of her pregnancy. But soon, I look preoccupied again. There's much to be anxious about. "Hey, Gulnaz, who are you dreaming about? Let us on," laughingly tease a group of girls. While one masks her wet hair with a paste of cleansing clay, a female bath attendant pours the leftover clay water over another's hair for softening and conditioning it. Being one of the Sultan's favourites, the girls both envy and admire my status. And I don't blame them. I have a separate chamber, a personal attendant, and beautiful kaftans made of the finest silks from Bursa. And if I were to give birth to a prince, my status and powers would be that of the chief consort. Yet only I know how little it all means to me, for my heart bleeds for Ahmed. "Stop it, Aisha. I'm only dreaming of the succulent lamb dish for our lunch today," I retaliate with a quick smile at the group's leader. I do not want to arouse any suspicion. The girls are sharp and may give me away to the assistant master, just to curry some future favours. Ladies of the Ottoman Empire emphasized maintaining a healthy, nourished appearance rather than relying on makeup. This meant elaborate bathing and grooming rituals with pure and natural products, ensuring a healthy diet, and exposing one to fresh outdoor air. Besides nutrition and digestion, a close connection between sleep and maintaining a youthful complexion was established. Another important aspect of daily grooming was the use of fragrances that also claimed to have aphrodisiac properties. The first stop at the hammam would be the steam room, where the heat allowed the muscles to relax and activated the blood and lymphatic circulation. As the heat opened up the pores, toxins were eliminated and the skin was deeply cleansed. This was followed by a cool rinse with bath water scented with violets and seasonal fragrant flowers. The masseuse, or bath attendant, then massaged the body, kneading the muscles with olive oil to relax and detoxify. This gave way to a scrubbing of the body with a coarse glove called a kese, or washcloth made of horsehair, to reduce cellulite and smoothen the skin. A slathering of soap derived from pure olive oil followed. Then the feet were scraped using pumice stone to dislodge dry skin and reveal smoother skin beneath. The finale, after rinsing and drying oneself, would be a smoothening over of some apricot kernel oil, made by first boiling finely broken kernels in water, then sieving and again heating the aqueous product in olive oil. The oil thus produced was used as a facial oil and applied on the hands. A quarter of an hour in the steam room has purged my body and mind of its stresses of the past few days. As the warmth seeps through my pores, my thoughts meander to evenings spent wrapped in Ahmed's arms, my head resting on his broad, warm chest. Now stretched out on the marble massage slab in the hot room, feeling my tense shoulder muscles relax under the expert strokes of the masseuse, I cannot stop my eyes from welling over as I look over at Anastasia. She's chewing on a miswak twig in the far corner to clean her teeth. Anastasia is from Kefalonia and arrived at the harem the same week as me, and we had grown close, sharing our secrets, fears, and longing for home. Together, we had learnt and become used to the ways of the harem and its rituals that bind us to an ancient way of living. But Anastasia had become ambitious about becoming a chief consort of the Sultan one day. "The Sultan will be mine alone, and so will this palace," she had laughingly declared on one of our walks in the Imperial Gardens. I had sensed her burning ambition under the light-hearted remark, and so I can no longer trust her enough with my plan. I am all alone in it, yet my desire for freedom gives me belief in myself. "Do you feel relaxed, milady?" asks the masseuse. I nod a yes, lazily. The Ottoman ladies trusted their beauty to the very best of the natural ingredients and ancient recipes thereof. Soaps were unscented and without chemicals, at times aged over years like wine. In 10th century Byzantium, later named Constantinople and today's Istanbul, there was a soap artisans guild, and their artisans produced soap with olive oil and tallow as the raw material. Soaps made of pure oil were used as hair cleansers. Another popular product was rose water for the face, rinsing with which promised smooth, problem and wrinkle-free skin. Rose oil, prepared by soaking rose petals in sesame and olive oil over days, was another common recipe for moisturizing hands, feet and the face. In addition, it was used in the treatment of mental illnesses in Ottoman medicine. A smooth, hairless body was expected, and body hair removal was another very crucial part of the beautifying rituals. To do so, the ladies used depilatories, like a paste of lemon juice and sugar called agda. The candy-like product was rolled on by hand until the hair adhered to it, and then pulled out. Sugar inside a lemon was also used as a skin-brightening scrub and for healing scars. Dental hygiene was maintained by chewing on the twig of the miswak tree or the Salvadora persica tree. A rinse with rock salt diluted in water brightened the teeth, and caries were kept at bay with a mouthwash of honey and vinegar. The harem would source its supplies of exotic and local clays, soaps, cleansers, fragrances and other toiletries from the merchants in the vibrant bazaars of the Ottoman Empire. I'm jolted out of my reverie as I hear Aisha calling out to me yet again. This girl. "Gulnaz, come! We're getting our hair henna today. Join us. Your highlights catch the sun so beautifully." I cannot refuse it, lest it led to a further inquisition by the garrulous Aisha. I walk over to the girls, balancing on my clogs, where the assistants are dipping their hands in the henna bowls and covering the girls' hair with the paste. As I reach the group and settle down, one of the assistants puts the fragrant henna on my hair. I sigh deeply. The coolness of the herbal paste on my head calms my nerves. Around me, women are busy in various stages of bathing. A few have moved to the cooling room to laze on daybeds, chatting with others and having fruit, tea, or sherbet. as their assistants braid pearl strings into their hair. After the henna has dried and getting updated with the latest on the palace gossip, I head to the kurna, or the water basin set around the marble-clad hall, to rinse my hair. An assistant scoops some flower-scented water with a filigreed silver bowl to remove the drying henna. My mind is now racing as the bath comes to a close. My moment of making a run for it is near, and a misstep could mean the difference between life and death. Ottoman ladies were renowned for their thick, lush head of hair. Apart from genetics, one can attribute it to the hours spent taking care of it with the most natural, pure, and nourishing products and rituals. For example, the water's properties would be softened and enhanced by boiling flowers of mallow, lotus, violet, hibiscus, fragrant flowers like roses and poppies, and healing ones like chamomile. Rinsing and washing the hair with softened water ensured a gentle wash. A recipe to condition the hair was rinsing it with the residual water in which the cleansing clay had been soaked. Clay and water were mixed in a clay container called kildanlik. Another kind of soap, called bitim sabanu, made from wild pistachios, was used for hair and body. It was known to have antiseptic properties and delay the appearance of grey hair. There were many ways to cover the greys or impart some hair highlights in the Ottoman Empire. One was letting the hair soak in the tea of boiled onion skins. Red onion for darker hair and white onion for lighter hair. One could also boil up some strong chamomile tea and douse the hair in it. Exposing the rinsed hair to sunlight was believed to bring out natural light-coloured highlights. Henna was a very popular remedy not just for colouring, but also fortifying the hair. It gives a beautiful red hue, which can be adjusted with the quantity of water, black tea, indigo, and olive oil added to the green powder. Ottoman women would henna their hair at the hammam and wrap it in henna towels with embroidered or crocheted edges. To impart shine and strength to the hair, almond oil was massaged onto the scalp and hair before washing it off with a paste of clay or soaps. Hair would be combed with combs made of ivory and plated with silver and gold. It is now or never. I send another prayer to the heavens for grace and protection. I know the old laundress and her son will be at the hammam in half an hour to pick up towels and linen and haul them out of the palace to their laundry by the Bosphorus. Wrapping a peshtemal around my body and my hair in a soft muslin towel, I indulge in one last ritual as I reach into my basket of toiletries and pull out the little bottle of lavender and carnation scent. Dabbing some of it on, I hope it's my talisman and brings me luck, just as it did for the erstwhile Queen Harem. The mist is now at its thickest. Musky and floral fragrances of various oils and scents mingle in the air, and the women are lulled into a blissful state of languor. Some start humming a concubine song that we had once composed. Others join in, and the notes rise and fall in unison. To my mind, it sounds like a rousing farewell, as if the women are singing for my freedom. I quietly open the door to the service room and make sure no one's there. In the tool and supply cabinet, just as I'd expected, I find a servant's outfit, a perfect disguise. Exotic fragrances were an inseparable part of the Ottoman culture, an olfactory heritage rooted in Islam and the city's geographical location, which saw a lot of trade in aromatic resins and spices. Beautiful scents were used across many civilizations before Islam, like the Sumerians, the Babylonians, the Urartu, the ancient Greeks, and the Roman Empire. Since nearly all these civilizations were either founded on or had ties with Anatolia, it can be said that Turkey has been the cradle of the perfume industry. At its fabled spice market, Genoese, Venetian, and other merchants traded in different spices and fragrant resins, also concocting recipes for creams, cosmetics, incense water, and perfumes. The Ottoman History Archives are rich with documentation of recipes for various scents, with rose, musk, and amber being the most preferred in the daily life of the Ottomans. Fragrances were not only used to make one smell good, but also as remedies for physical and mental illnesses. They were not only worn, but also consumed by adding them to syrups on desserts and in sherbets. The scents were produced in special kitchens, where flower water and soaps were also produced. These scents were then distributed to royal officers at the palace. Common people bought their scents from attars or merchants, who also sold natural drugs, folk remedies, and flower waters. Scents were also used to signal secret or subliminal messages. A young girl would hint at her desire to get married by using some redbud fragrance. A family with a marriage proposal for another's daughter would bring lily fragrance as a gift, while rose oil and musk was used on the bodies of new brides. During labour, women were made to smell rose water and their bodies rubbed with rose oil to ease delivery. Fragrance of hyacinth on a handkerchief hinted at displeasure, hurt, or anger. At the palace, elaborate rituals revolved around fragrances. A coffee ceremony hosted by an imperial lady has been described as such. There would be 40 servants serving rose water to the guests and carrying out other scent rituals. The ceremony would start with a server entering the room holding an incense burner. Rose water would then be poured over each guest's hands, and a dessert with cinnamon or clove would be served to give a fresh smell to breath while chatting. Finally, coffee would be served. Sultans also used fragrances in state meetings, like wearing oud, or agar wood, as a symbol of political wit and justice. If a foreign delegate was offered rose water in the morning, he knew it meant a meeting with the Sultan that day. He would also wear a rose fragrance to the meeting to ensure he smelled good for the Sultan. As oud, amber, and musk were the fragrances of the Prophet Muhammad, they were used in the ink of correspondences with the holy cities of Mecca and Medina after they were conquered by Yavuz Sultan Selim. The sultans and their wives also had strong personal preferences. Suleiman the Magnificent preferred amber, musk, and rose, while Harem Sultan, his chief consort, preferred jasmine, lavender, rose, and carnation fragrances. Legend goes that she would massage her feet with 70 grams of lavender oil, so that whenever she walked, her wake would be lavender-scented. I quickly slip into the servant's outfit and ensure the giant laundry basket in the service room is full with the week's linen. I hear the voices of two women approach and duck behind the basket. Thankfully, the voices fade as the assistant masters in charge of escorting us back to the harem pass by the hall. I must hurry. I finish wrapping the servant's turban around my head, take a deep breath, and hoist myself into the tall basket, dragging the piles of moist towels over my head. I hear footsteps and some voices again. It's the limping laundress and her strong son. I am now well buried under heaps of linen and feel the basket being lifted and carried onto the cart waiting outside. The son of the laundress remarks about the heavy load today and is duly chided by his mother, who reminds him of the dozens of out-of-state guests this week. The cart is now rolling across the imperial garden towards the palace gates. My heart beats wildly, with fear and excitement. Though a little suffocated, I hold my breath, lest I give myself away. A sudden jolt tells me we have crossed over the mound just outside the gates. A slow realization dawns. I gently lift my head out from underneath to peek through the lid as I hear mother and son arguing. I turn to look. There it is, the Sublime Porte, behind us.
This was an episode of Beauty Rituals Through the Centuries from Officine Universelle Bully. You will soon find a new story that will take you on a journey through time. Our podcasts are available on all listening platforms.